She unfastened and shrugged off her bra, which was her last remaining article of clothing, and joined him in the bed. 5 hours later, her plane landed in Cincinnati. Chapter 7. Mrs. Bennett had not, as it turned out, needed to lean on Mrs. Lucas excessively in order to convince the latter to facilitate a meeting between the Bennett daughters and Chip Bingley. Upon receiving Mrs. Bennett's phone call, Mrs. Lucas had declared that nothing could bring her greater pleasure or reflect more flatteringly on Cincinnati than the attendance of the beautiful Bennett girls and their parents at the barbecue that the Lucases were hosting for several recent arrivals to Christ Hospital, where Dr. Lucas was both a physician and a high-ranking executive. Mrs. Lucas shared with Mrs. Bennett the affliction of an unmarried adult daughter, though in Mrs. Lucas's case the disappointment was embodied just once rather than multiplied fivefold. Charlotte Lucas, who had been Liz's classmate and closest friend at Seven Hills for 15 years, was also single, a bright and poised human resources manager at Procter & Gamble, who, since graduating from college, had been about 75 pounds overweight. To Mrs. Bennett's mind, this fact placed Mrs. Lucas's misfortune in a separate, albeit equally frustrating, category from the one in which her own daughters fell. Obviously, Charlotte wasn't married because she was heavy. Therefore, she simply needed to go on a diet. Mrs. Bennett's own daughters, however, possessing no discernible physical or personal flaws, except for poor homely Mary, had no clear means of remediation. Mrs. Bennett, who herself was not a stranger to rotundity, had wondered if Mrs. Lucas considered Charlotte a candidate for Chip's affections. But Mrs. Lucas's unhesitating inclusion of the Bennets at the barbecue reassured Mrs. Bennett that her friend harbored no unrealistic expectations where Charlotte was concerned. Thus, despite having failed to pair off any of her daughters in the 2 decades she'd been actively trying, Mrs. Bennett's hopes for the barbecue were high indeed. The Lucases lived in Indian Hill, a suburb 15 miles from downtown and home to the sort of Cincinnatians who enjoyed owning horses, or at least purebred dogs who could roam on multi-acre properties. The Lucas's house was a vast brick colonial with a balcony over the front door and a slate roof. In the kitchen, various Bennets embraced various Lucases. Jane passed off her sponge cake, and Liz walked to the window to survey the dozen or so guests already chatting on the flagstone patio in the backyard. "Jane, come see your future husband," she called merrily. Jane joined her. "I take it Chip Bingley is the tall, dark, and handsome one?" Charlotte Lucas said, "No, Chip is the guy in the seersucker shorts. The tall, dark, and handsome one is his friend Fitzwilliam Darcy, who joined the Stroke Center at the University of Cincinnati last year as a neurosurgeon. The rumor is he's also single, but he's kind of standoffish. He and Chip went to medical school together." Charlotte turned to Jane. "Did you really never watch Eligible when Chip was on?" "She's never watched any of Eligible," Liz said. "She's like a unicorn." "Oh, Chip's season was fantastic," Charlotte said. "There was an actual physical fight involving ripped-out hair extensions." Mary, who had caught up to her mother's car on the drive out, said, "I find Eligible degrading to women." "So you've mentioned..." Liz glanced at Charlotte. "Did you say Chip's friend's name is Fitzwilliam? And if so, did he just sail over on the Mayflower?" "He goes by his last name," Charlotte grinned, "though I'm not sure Darcy is much better." In recent years, Charlotte and Liz hadn't spent time together beyond Christmas parties or lunches scheduled during Liz's trips home from New York, but they still took immense pleasure in each other's company. Indeed, it had been one of the highlights of Liz's longer-term return to Cincinnati to resume her friendship with Charlotte in a genuine fashion as adults, and to find that her enjoyment of the woman was no less than it had been of the girl. They only half-jokingly speculated about whether they were the last two single people from their high school class, though Liz wondered if Charlotte suffered from this distinction more acutely. Charlotte lived in Cincinnati, where her mother could nag her at closer proximity. She didn't have the buffer of an older sister who was, ostensibly, even more overdue to marry. She did wish to have children, and she didn't have a secret boyfriend. "Chip is shorter than he looks on TV, right?" Charlotte said. "But definitely cute. And that guy in the V-neck, Keith, is another new emergency doctor." The man in question was black, the only non-white person at the party. "And the woman in the striped dress is an intern. The man next to her is her husband, and that toddler is theirs." In addition to these guests were an attractive blonde woman Liz didn't recognize, and two older couples Liz had previously met at the Lucas's New Year's Day open house. The men in both couples also worked as doctors at Christ Hospital. "Is Keith single too?" Liz asked. "Because if he is, Jane, there's basically a man buffet for you to pick from."
"I might remind you," Mr. Bennett said as he blithely fixed himself a gin and tonic at the nearby wet bar, "that you're not observing those gentlemen from behind a two-way mirror."
Mr. Bennett held up his hand, and Dr. Lucas waved back. "I doubt they read lips," Liz said. Jane turned to Charlotte. "Is the blonde woman a doctor?"
"That's Caroline Bingley, Chip's sister. She lives in L.A., but she's helping him get settled here."
"Chip is handsome," Jane said, and Liz and Charlotte exchanged an amused look.
"Then let's go out and I'll introduce you," Charlotte said.
Chapter 8. After the flurry of greetings, Liz found herself talking to Keith, who was congenial, and she quickly discovered engaged to a woman finishing her medical residency in San Diego. By the time the chicken breasts had been grilled and the potato salad, coleslaw, and rolls set out, Liz and Keith had covered the topics of San Diego's climate, Cincinnati's climate, and Cincinnati's famous chili, which Keith had not yet sampled. As Liz and Keith moved on to Keith's interest in golf, Liz was gratified to observe that Jane appeared to be deep in conversation with Chip Bingley. That conversation continued as Jane and Chip procured food and took seats side by side on a mortared stone retaining wall, soon joined by Chip's sister Caroline. When Liz had prepared her own plate of food, she walked to the four-person patio table where Fitzwilliam Darcy was sitting with the husband of the intern and one of the older doctors. The older doctor and the husband were discussing how the Reds were faring this season, and addressing Fitzwilliam Darcy, or, Liz reminded herself, just Darcy, Liz pointed to the empty chair. "Is this seat taken?"
"It is," Darcy said.
He didn't temper his rebuff with any apology, and Liz assumed he must have misheard her. He must have thought she'd asked if the seat was free. She said, "It is taken?"
"Yes," Darcy said,
and he remained unapologetic.
"It is."
In spite of Charlotte's warning about Darcy seeming standoffish, Liz was so disconcerted that she was tempted to say, "Forgive me for imagining I was worthy of sharing your table." So he had gone to Harvard Medical School. So he was a neurosurgeon. Neither fact gave him carte blanche to be rude. Before moving away, she smiled in a manner she hoped he understood was fake. Spying Kitty and Lydia nearby, Liz walked to them and perched on the cushioned ottoman by Kitty's knees. Her younger sisters were debating the ideal time to arrive at their next gathering, which apparently would be hosted by the owner of their CrossFit gym. Lydia pointed toward the roll on Liz's plate.
"Don't carbs make you feel sluggish?"
Everything in moderation, Liz said.
There were many reasons she found her sister's enthusiasm for CrossFit and the paleo diet irritating, including that Liz herself had been familiar with both long before they had, having written an article about CrossFit back in 2007. Another source of irritation was that her sisters looked fantastic. They had always been attractive, but since taking up CrossFit, they were practically glowing with energy and strength. When Liz's phone vibrated in her pocket, she was almost finished eating and even more insulted by Darcy's snub than she'd been at first, because the chair beside him had remained empty all this time. She took the opportunity to go inside, wash the barbecue sauce from her hands at the kitchen sink, and check the message.
Southampton biggest clusterfuck of all time, read the text from Jasper, and she typed back,
hang in there. When fireworks?
God knows, but none will be as bright as you, Jasper texted.
A reference to my sparkling personality or sequined nipple pasties? Liz typed.
Yowza,
Jasper replied.
Standing just inside the back door, looking down at her phone, Liz gradually became aware of a conversation occurring on the screen door's other side. After focusing for a few seconds, she realized the speakers were Chip Bingley and Fitzwilliam Darcy.
Much better than I expected, Chip was saying. When I told people I was moving to Cincinnati, I was practically getting condolences, but it's not bad at all. Said like a man who's just spent an hour talking to the only good-looking woman at the party. Darcy replied, not counting your sister, of course.
Liz could hear the rattle of ice cubes. Then Darcy added,
I'm sure they do their best, but Cincinnatians are painfully provincial.
Inside the kitchen, Liz smiled. It was oddly satisfying to receive confirmation of Darcy's snobbishness. In a friendly tone, Chip said,
in your first year here, you didn't find any Lady Buckeyes who met your exacting standards. I can hardly think of anything less tempting, Darcy said.
Chip chuckled.
Someone told me Jane's sister Liz is single, too. I suppose it would be unchivalrous to say I'm not surprised.
Liz's jaw dropped. Abruptly, the eavesdropping had ceased to be satisfying. Who did this man think he was? And what did he have against her personally? When being introduced, they hadn't exchanged more than 10 words.
Here's what I've learned about the people in this city, Darcy was saying. They grade their women on a curve. If someone is described as sophisticated, it means once during college she visited Paris. And if someone is described as beautiful, it means she's 15 pounds overweight instead of 40. And they're obsessed with matchmaking. They act like they're doing you a favor by conscripting you to have coffee with the elementary school teacher from their church during the 2 free hours you might have in an entire week. I've lost count of how many of my colleagues' wives have tried to set me up. With your having been on TV, they must be licking their chops. You know what? Chip said. I'm making it my mission to get you a social life in Cincinnati. And don't try to tell me that's an oxymoron. If all you have is 2 hours a week, let's make them a great 2 hours.
His affectionate tone was, Liz thought, no particular credit to him. Not only was Chip apparently unmoved to defend her from Darcy's aspersions, but it hadn't even seemed to occur to the former that his friend's words were offensive.
Good for you, if you like it here now, Darcy said, and I don't mean that facetiously. But I'll be curious what you think this time next year.
As Chip began speaking, Liz pushed open the screen door and in an emphatically friendly tone said, Hi! She glanced from Chip's face to Darcy's, and making eye contact with Darcy, held his gaze for an extra beat. I was just inside thinking what grade I'd give myself, she said. I realized it would be an A+, but I've heard we grade on a curve here, so I'm probably, what, more like a B for the coasts? Or a B-? If you have a minute to figure it out, be sure to let me know. Without waiting for either to respond, she walked past them, eager to repeat Darcy's comments as widely and quickly as she could. Chapter 9. Liz and Jane went for their usual run the next morning, and they had just passed Edwards Road when Jane said, "So Chip texted after we went to bed to see if I want to get dinner tomorrow night." "He already texted? For dinner? On a Saturday night? Jane, he's smitten with you." "I don't know," Jane said. "What do you not know? You guys practically had to be pried apart when we left the Lucases." "He's really nice," Jane said, "and attractive, obviously. But the situation is so contrived. His having been on TV, Mom scheming to get us introduced. Doesn't that make it seem ridiculous? There's not the tiniest shred of doubt in my mind that you'll find your dream man sooner or later. If it happens to be someone Mom pushed you toward, well, even a stopped clock is right twice a day." "It's made life simpler that since I started the IUI, I haven't met anyone I've wanted to go out with," Jane said. "Because what would I say on a date? I like you, but by the way, once a month I get anonymous sperm shot into my uterus. Hope that won't put a damper on things." "You're getting ahead of yourself," Liz said. "Just go out to dinner with him." Jane was quiet, and Liz said, "I can hear you ruminating." "What?" "I know I shouldn't make a big deal out of one date," Jane said slowly, "but I can't help doing the math. What if we start dating? We go out for 3 months or 6 months or 18 months, and then we break up. By that point, I'm 40 or 41. "You're not having IUI while you're here, right?" Liz looked at Jane, who nodded. "Starting the process again at a new clinic is too complicated," Jane said. "In that case, give Chip a chance while we're in Cincinnati. Have a summer fling. You did like him." They were passing Corbin Drive, and Jane said softly, almost so softly Liz couldn't hear, "That's true. I liked him a lot." Chapter 10. "The thing I'm confused about," Liz said to Mary, "is what day does Mervetta come? Because the house is getting gross." A twice-monthly fixture at the Tudor since Liz's childhood, Mervetta cleaned the Bennett's toilets, vacuumed their rugs, and changed their sheets. Once, when Liz was 10, Mervetta had told her that the Bennett's were the only white people she'd ever known who ate grits. Mary's expression was both uncomfortable and amused, as if Liz had made an offensive joke that Mary wished she didn't find funny. She said, "Mervetta died." "Oh, God," Liz said. "No one told me." "Maybe because before that, Mom fired her. She caught her sitting on Lydia's bed watching TV." Liz winced. "So who cleans the house now?" Mary shrugged. "Nobody." The two sisters were standing in the kitchen. Liz had just returned from lunch with Charlotte Lucas. Liz said, "Did anyone go to Mervetta's funeral?" Mary shrugged again. "I didn't." Chapter 11.
"Your mother has shared a tragic piece of news about Cousin Willie with me," Mr. Bennett said when the family was assembled for dinner. "He's coming to visit."
"Really, Fred?" Mrs. Bennett said, and Jane said, "Dad, that's an awful way to set us up." Mr. Bennett smiled as if he'd been doubly complimented.
As you all know, my sister is flying out next week to check if I still have a pulse, and in the event that I don't, to take possession of our mother's silver. For reasons that elude me, her stepson has decided to accompany her.
Liz swallowed a spoonful of the gazpacho Jane had prepared and said, I know you all find this hard to believe, but Cousin Willie is kind of a big deal.
And if I were an insomniac, Mr. Bennett replied, I'd like nothing better than to hear him explain why.
Maybe he can tell us why the internet in this house is so slow, Kitty said. Or teach Mom to use her cell phone, Lydia suggested. His startups have made millions of dollars, Liz said.
And Mr. Bennett said, yet he doesn't know how to put on a pair of trousers.
That was 1986, Jane said. Which indeed it had been. The summer before Liz had started sixth grade, the Bennets had made a trip to California to visit Mr. Bennett's sister, Margot, and to meet the man to whom she had just become engaged, a widower with a 3-year-old son. Someone, Mr. and Mrs. Bennett each vehemently denied responsibility, had decided it would be a lark to make the journey by car. Thus, the Bennett family had set out from Cincinnati in their minivan, driving roughly 500 miles a day for 5 days in a row. At the time, Jane was 12, Liz 11, Mary 3, Kitty in utero, and Lydia not yet conceived. In Liz's memory, the trip was a blur of rolling hills becoming flattened prairies becoming sprawling ranch lands, and ranch lands becoming scrubby desert. In Utah, a detour to see the Red Rock region had been scuttled due to increasing familial tensions. The minivan's back seats had become a mayhem of hair-pulling, girl farts, and toddler squalls that distracted Liz from her powerful wish to reach the end of the tawdry romance she was reading, in which a brooding Cheyenne loner inserted his fingers into the most private cavity of a young British heiress while they rode upon the same horse. Liz's utter thrall to Colt and Jocelyn's story compelled her to ignore a building nausea that eventually asserted itself with her crying out, I'm going to be sick! And vomiting an Egg McMuffin, hash browns, and ketchup onto Mary 50 miles northeast of Sacramento. Liz did sometimes wonder if their relationship had ever properly recovered, and insofar as it hadn't, she couldn't blame her sister. By the time the Bennets pulled into the driveway of the home belonging to Aunt Margot's new fiancé in Sausalito, the minivan was strewn with food wrappers and socks and discarded Mad Libs books, not only reeking of vomit, but also making an unaccountable scraping noise on the rear right side of the undercarriage. The Bennets' antipathy for one another was of such an intimate variety, it was almost like affection. They spilled out of the car and walked up the brick path of a well-tended bungalow, but before they could ring the bell, the front door opened, and a small, red-haired boy stood before them completely naked.
Dad! The boy yelled. They're here!
His limbs were alabaster, his penis minuscule, and, particularly to Mary, bewildering.
Look away, girls! Mrs. Bennett cried,
prompting in Liz and Jane a fit of giggles. This was Cousin Willie, and also, obviously, Cousin Willie's Willie. Over the years, the Bennets and the Collinses saw one another intermittently, and at some point it became apparent that Cousin Willie was a bit of a technology savant. He taught himself to code at 13, began advising local businesses on how to bolster their web presences at 15, and dropped out of UCLA during his sophomore year after selling a company that had developed a proprietary format for transmitting data between servers and web applications. Which was to say, a company no Bennett understood whatsoever, for a rumored $20 million. Now a man of 30, Willie was running his third or fourth software development startup. And yet all of the Bennets except Liz and her mother refused to see him as anything other than a naked 3-year-old. Mrs. Bennet was clearly intrigued by his money and had once asked Liz a series of probing questions about how he'd received the payment for his first company, questions to which Liz didn't know the answers. And Liz herself had some years back run into Willie at a technology conference in Las Vegas that she was attending as a journalist, and had shared a surprisingly pleasant lunch with him. Although the conversation had essentially been a monologue on his part, it had been an interesting monologue, and he was the person who had first told her about Twitter. At the dinner table, Mrs. Bennet said, "Jane, I imagine you'll be busy with Chip Bingley, but Liz can entertain Willie when he's here." "Why will Jane be busy with Chip Bingley?" Kitty asked. With relish, Mrs. Bennet said, "They're having dinner tomorrow night at Orchids." Uncertainly, Jane said, "Mom, you haven't been reading my texts, have you?" Merrily, Lydia said, "She doesn't know how." Mrs. Bennet appeared uncontrite. "Helen Lucas mentioned it." Jane furrowed her eyebrows, which for her reflected genuine pique. "How would Mrs. Lucas know?" Liz cleared her throat. "I think I told Charlotte, but just in passing. Chip and I might never see each other again after Saturday." Jane's cheeks were flushed. "So please, can everyone not make a big deal out of this? Mom, I'll have plenty of time to spend with Cousin Willie."
"It was obvious that Chip found you absolutely charming, Jane," Mrs. Bennet said, "and so he should have. But you'll have to ask why he didn't go into private practice. Working in an emergency room, he must see very unattractive people."
Liz, who felt some responsibility for displeasing her sister, said, "I wonder if Willie is interested in visiting the Freedom Center."
"Just so you all know, I have a paper due at the end of next week," Mary said. "I won't have much time for Willie or Aunt Margot."
"That's so heartbreaking," Lydia said. "I wonder if they'll ever recover from the devastation."
"Well, I look forward to seeing both of them," Jane said.
From the head of the table, Mr. Bennet said,
"That makes one of us."
Chapter 12. After dinner, Liz followed the scent of nail polish to its source, which turned out, as was often the case, to be Kitty. She sat on the counter in the bathroom she and Lydia shared, the door open, painting a rather impressive pattern on her toenails of cream-colored polish with sparkly gold dots. Liz turned on the overhead fan.
"You know how Dad sleeps in his study?" she said. "Is it because of the Jewish thing?"
Without looking up, Kitty said,
"Maybe." "Do you think it is?"
At last, Kitty met Liz's eyes.
"Ask them."
Liz had no intention of doing so. Mr. Bennett's two great and overlapping interests were genealogy and history. When capable of driving himself, he whiled away many afternoons in the stacks of the Mercantile Library downtown, and at some point, about a decade prior, he'd announced with amusement his discovery that Mrs. Bennet's maternal grandmother had been Jewish. Indeed, prior to her marriage, Ida Connor had been Ida Rosenbluth. While not an overt anti-Semite, Mrs. Bennet was prone to making declarations about almost all religious and ethnic minorities that were often uncomfortable for her listeners.
"Jews are very fond of dried fruit,"
she'd told Liz on more than one occasion, and when Liz had been in fifth grade, Mrs. Bennet had refused to purchase a party dress for her that had a black sequined bodice and a black velvet skirt on the grounds that it was Jewish-looking. Unsurprisingly, Mrs. Bennet wasn't receptive to Mr. Bennet's pronouncement about her religious ancestry. Adding insult to injury, Lydia and Kitty took to referring to their mother, in and out of her presence, as the Jewess. In fact, Lydia once reduced Mrs. Bennet to tears by recommending that she have a late-in-life bat mitzvah. This teasing had faded over time, possibly replaced with Lydia's badgering of Mary about her sexual orientation. But perhaps, Liz thought, the consequences of the genealogical discovery lingered still. In the bathroom, Liz said to Kitty, "You don't think Mom and Dad would ever get divorced, do you?" The more pointed question, which Liz didn't ask, was, "Do you think they should?" Kitty made a scoffing sound. "They're too lazy," she said. Chapter 13. On Saturday evening, just before being picked up by Chip Bingley, Jane stood in front of the mirror that hung over Liz's bureau, applying blush. As she glanced at Liz's reflection, Jane said, "Should I have watched his season of Eligible? Are there things everyone else knows about him that I don't?" Liz sat at her desk, where she planned to spend the next few hours working. Her parents were having dinner at the country club with neighbors. Lydia and Kitty were headed out. Mary was in her own room with the door closed. Although already, both quite accidentally and quite horribly, Liz had found herself on a web page featuring cannibal lemurs. Given that she was researching an upcoming mascara feature on how to ask for a raise, it was difficult to say exactly how this had happened. Liz pushed her chair back and set her feet on the edge of her desk in a way her mother had been objecting to for 3 decades. "Did you tell him at the Lucases you've never seen the show?" she asked. Jane nodded. "Then that might be part of your charm," Liz said. "He came off like a good guy, I promise. He did his share of on-air smooching, but he wasn't sleazy. He told me that patients sometimes ask for his autograph." Jane appeared troubled rather than gratified. "Can you imagine?" "Here's my one hesitation about him," Liz said. "And it's not huge, but for what it's worth, there's this idea that he didn't want to be on Eligible and his sister talked him into it. I call bullshit on that. People only do reality TV because they want to. I read somewhere that everyone on those shows is trying to make it in Hollywood." Jane set down her blush container and turned to face Liz. "You think?" Liz shrugged. "He wouldn't be the first. Aren't you the one who encouraged me to go out with him tonight? It could be that he saw Eligible as a lark and thought, why not? I didn't get an egomaniacal vibe when I talked to him. I just don't totally buy his backstory." "I'm almost afraid to tell you this now," Jane said. "But you know how his sister Caroline is here for a few weeks from L.A.?" "I saw her at the Lucases, but we hardly talked." "She's his manager," Jane said. Liz squinted. "Meaning what?" "I guess ever since Eligible, he gets approached about product endorsements or doing charity events. She handles all of that for him." Liz struggled not to form an expression of distaste. Caroline Bingley had, on the 4th of July, revealed herself to Liz to be almost as unappealing as Fitzwilliam Darcy. As Caroline, her brother, and Darcy had been about to depart together, Caroline had first told Liz that she kept forgetting whether she was in Cleveland, Cincinnati, or Columbus. Then she'd lamented the local dearth of decent sushi or yoga. Liz had considered recommending Moto Yoga, which was the studio Jane frequented, but decided instead to withhold the kindness. Liz had, by that point in the party, shared Darcy's remarks with other attendees, animated as she did so by a giddy and outraged fervor. Charlotte Lucas had laughed, Mrs. Bennet had been deeply insulted, and Jane had speculated that Darcy had known she was eavesdropping and had been joking, which Liz thought gave Darcy far too much credit. In her bedroom, Liz said to Jane, "Maybe you and Chip can get paid to show up together at nightclubs.
That would be funny.
You're sending very mixed messages right now, Lizzie.
Liz grinned. I contain multitudes, she added.
Sorry. Just enjoy yourself tonight and forget I said anything.
Chapter 14.
Liz was still at her desk, though actually doing work. She was reading a commencement speech delivered by Kathy DeBerg, a famous feminist whom she hoped to interview for her pay raise article, when Lydia entered the room and said,
"Have you seen my phone?"
Liz shook her head.
"Fuck,"
Lydia said. "I need to text Ham to see what time we're meeting, but my phone is the only place I have his number."
"Who's Ham?"
"Ham Ryan." "Am I supposed to know who that is?" Liz asked.
"He owns the box we go to."
Box, to Liz's annoyance, was the preferred CrossFit term for its gyms. She said, "Is he your boyfriend?" Lydia's expression was disdainful. Sarcastically, she said,
"Are we going steady? Do you think he'll give me his varsity jacket?"
"Excuse me for daring to make conversation with you after you came into my room."
"There's a spider on your wall."
At first, Liz wondered if this was some coded insult used by millennials. But when she turned, she saw a real spider, brown and quarter-sized. She stood to grab a sandal, and when she whacked the shoe against the wall, a chip of paint flaked off.
"Gross," Lydia said.
"Tell me if you find my phone." She hadn't yet left the room when Liz opened a new window on her web browser and typed in, "Ham Ryan CrossFit Cincinnati." He was handsome, of course. Short, light brown hair, coaxed by product into a sort of glistening spikiness, as well as blue eyes and a tidy goatee. His real name was Hamilton, apparently, and he was from Seattle. Liz cared little about either CrossFit or Lydia's paramours. Their turnover was too frequent to justify investing much attention. While finding Kathy DeBerg's commencement address genuinely interesting, yet, somehow, she spent the next 40 minutes exploring the nooks and crannies of the website for Ham Ryan's Fox, and even came away half-tempted to try a recipe for paleo crab cakes, if only doing so wouldn't please her sisters.
Chapter 15.
Close to midnight, as Liz was shutting down her computer, she heard someone ascending the staircase to the third floor. To her surprise, it was Mary rather than Jane. On Mary's face was an unconcealed smirk.
"Look,"
she passed her phone to Liz. The small screen showed an item on a celebrity gossip website that Liz thought of as holding greater appeal for Kitty and Lydia than Mary, with a headline that read, "Flunky Hunky. Did eligible bachelor almost fail out of Harvard Medical School?" Below was a photo of Chip Bingley in a tuxedo, clinking champagne flutes with one of the comely female finalists from his season. Liz skimmed the entry, which was only a paragraph. Former classmates say Bingley was known more for hitting the bike trails than the books, then gave back the phone.
"So,"
she said, "he passed his boards, obviously."
"If you cut off your finger, would you want him to be the one to stitch it on?"
"The fact that he wasn't first in his class doesn't mean he's incompetent." Mary raised her eyebrows dubiously. "I knew there was something fishy about a graduate of Harvard Medical School ending up in an ER in Cincinnati. It was probably the only job he could get." This seemed a rather presumptuous judgment from someone who herself had never been employed.
"Don't show that to anyone," Liz said. "Even if it's true, it's irrelevant."
Chapter 16.
At 5:30 in the morning, Liz awoke to the rustling of Jane slipping into the twin bed across from hers.
"Yikes," Liz mumbled. "I guess it was a successful date."
"Oh, Lizzie," Jane said. "Chip's amazing."
Chapter 17. After dinner at Orchids, Jane and Chip had moved on to Bakersfield for drinks. Liz didn't learn any of this until the afternoon, because Jane not only slept through their morning run, but also skipped the 11 a.m. service at Knox Presbyterian Church that Mary and Mrs. Bennett attended every Sunday, Liz and Jane attended when in town, and all other Bennets eschewed except at Christmas. Following drinks, did you actually drink, or were you fostering a hospitable uterus again? Liz asked. And Jane said she'd had one glass of wine at dinner and another at the bar. Jane and Chip had returned to his apartment in Oakley, where they'd taken the opportunity to discover that they were a couple truly compatible in all ways.
"Do you think I'm slutty?" Jane asked.
"You're 39 years old," Liz said. "You should do what you want."
"Was it weird with his sister there?"
Jane shook her head.
"The room she's staying in is at the opposite end of the apartment."
Jane was still lying in bed as she relayed these facts, and Liz sat on the other twin bed.
"It wasn't awkward with Chip at all. And neither of us was drunk," Jane added. "I really like him. I felt a way I hadn't for so long. And it barely had to do with how good-looking he is. He is good-looking, but I was just so comfortable with him. He's genuinely nice and not self-centered. I really don't think he's an aspiring actor. He told me the eligible producers got in touch recently asking him to be on a reunion show, and he said no."
"Then I stand corrected."
"He also was mortified you'd overheard him and Darcy talking at the Lucases. He wanted me to tell you how sorry he is, and how he doesn't share Darcy's view of Cincinnati at all."
Liz smiled. "At least when it comes to the women here, I'd say that's obvious."
"Really, though?"
Jane's expression was serious.
"Chip says Darcy can be kind of brusque, but he's a really good person and a world-class surgeon."
"With a world-class ego, apparently." "Just to warn you, Mom's downstairs practically salivating. She knows you were out late."
"You didn't tell her how late, did you?"
"No, but I can't promise she wasn't looking out the window when Chip dropped you off."
"It's funny, isn't it?" Jane said. "Because think how much trouble I'd have gotten in back in high school for coming home from a date at 5 in the morning. But I just had to wait 20 years. And now Mom's probably thrilled."
Chapter 18. "I've got a question that you need not repeat to any of your sisters," Mr. Bennett said. He and Liz sat in an exam room at the orthopedist's office, waiting for the removal of the cast on his arm, a duty Jane had told Liz she didn't think she could sit through.
"I'm afraid I'll throw up,"
Jane had said, and Liz had said,
"Because of the saw?"
Jane had shook her head and said,
"Because of the smell."
"This business about Mary being homosexual," Mr. Bennett continued, "do you think there's anything to it?"
Surprised, Liz said,
"Why?"
"Your mother wouldn't like it, of course. But what's the old saying about people going about their business as long as they don't do it in the street and frighten the horses?"
"Wow, Dad," Liz said. "Have you become a Democrat?" Her father shuddered.
"Scarcely. But where does Mary go on Tuesday nights?"
"You could ask her. Where she goes, I mean, not if she's gay. Well, you could ask her that, too, although I don't know if I would." Liz had concluded some years earlier that Mary wasn't interesting enough to be gay,
All the gay people Liz knew in New York, both men and women, were a little more something than average. A little more thoughtful or stylish or funny. Though perhaps, Liz reflected, it was New York itself rather than gayness that accounted for their extra appeal.
If Mary has a friend she doesn't think she can bring to dinner, that'd be rather a shame,
Mr. Bennett said.
Her significant other deserves to suffer as much as the rest of us.
He was looking at Liz directly, and she tried not to squirm. Was he talking about Mary? Or was he actually alluding to her and Jasper? She must have her reasons, Liz said. You did just say yourself that Mom would be horrified.
Your mother is horrified many times a day.
At least now Mom has Chip Bingley to pin her hopes on. Did you know he and Jane went out for the second time last night? They went to a movie. Before Mr. Bennett could answer, the door opened, and there appeared a male nurse in aqua-colored scrubs, carrying the plastic saw with its round blade at one end. The entire contraption wasn't much larger than an electric toothbrush.
Fred, the nurse said, though they had never met.
How are we today?
Reading the nurse's name tag, Mr. Bennett replied with fake enthusiasm,
Bernard, we're mourning the death of manners and the rise of overly familiar discourse. How are you?
Chapter 19. Remember Alan Bausch? Mrs. Bennett said as Liz sat by herself at the kitchen table eating lunch. Liz looked at her mother with curiosity. Mary's prom date?
You should find him on the computer and send him a message from Mary. That's something that happens a lot now. Couples find each other on their computer after losing touch, and then they get married.
He's probably married to someone else.
He isn't. His aunt is in the Women's League.
Either way, why would I reach out to him? Shouldn't Mary do it?
She can be so stubborn.
Were Mary and Alan even a couple? They might have just gone to prom as friends.
He's a lawyer in Atlanta, and he's very active in his church, Mrs. Bennett said. If that's not the description of a man looking for a wife, I don't know what is.
Chapter 20. Charlotte Lucas called Liz midweek. I'm organizing a game night for Friday, she said. Can you come? And can you tell your sisters?
Do you remember that Lydia cheats?
Is it possible to cheat at charades?
Oh, she'll find a way, Liz said. I think Jane's going out with Chip again Friday.
For the third time, if you can believe it.
But I'm definitely in, and I'll try to round up Mary or Kitty.
Jane should bring Chip. Or should I invite him myself?
Liz hesitated. On the one hand, the chance to observe her sister and Chip together was tempting. On the other hand, if Chip attended game night, and Liz nerdily, unabashedly adored game nights, he might bring his sister, or worse, Fitzwilliam Darcy.
But who was she to exclude others?
Sure, she said to Charlotte. Call Chip.
Chapter 21. So depressing and uncomfortable had Liz found the update about Mervetta that in searching for new house cleaners, she sought agencies that would send rotating crews of three rather than an individual, with whom Mrs. Bennett might have a falling out. With estimates in hand for both cleaning and yard services, Liz knocked on the door of her father's study. When he called,
"There's no one home," she pushed the door open.
Mr. Bennett's desk, which he sat behind, faced into the room so that Liz saw the back rather than the front of his computer. Aside from this computer, her father's study looked as it had when his parents had sold the house to him in 1982 for the sum of $1. the same year they sold their summer home in Petoskey, Michigan, to his sister Margot for the same price. Indeed, it was quite possible that Mr. Bennett's study, with its sleigh bed, brown velvet curtains, leather-topped writing desk — the leather was burnt red and had a border of gold-leaf embossing — and porcelain desk lamp with fringed shade, was unchanged since Liz's grandparents had first moved into the Tudor in 1927. In her youth, Liz had understood her father to be an important businessman, an investor. He had driven each morning to a two-room office on Hyde Park Square, where he'd employed a secretary named Mrs. Lupshaw. And it was only with the passage of time that Liz realized that the investments he oversaw were solely those belonging to his immediate family, and that further, their oversight accounted for the entirety of his job. This realization had been so gradual that it was not until her junior year of college, when a friend of Liz's said of the wealthy older guy the friend was dating, "He pretends to work, but I think he's one of those men who push around piles of his family's money," that Liz felt an unwelcome sense of recognition. A decade earlier, when her father had retired, Liz had wished she did not have the cruel thought, "From what?" Liz entered the study. "I've found people to clean up the house in the yard," she said. She glanced at the reporter's notebook in her hand. "I'm thinking I'll have them both come every 2 weeks, though obviously you'll need the yard people less after the summer. When Mrs. Bildyer dropped off banana bread, she gave me the name of the cleaning service she uses, and she said they're great." Her father's eyes were focused on the computer screen as he said,
"Your mother cleans the house and I mow the lawn."
"In theory, maybe. But you still don't have full mobility, and Mom is so focused on her Women's League luncheon." Following the removal of his cast the day before, Mr. Bennett's right arm was pale, shrunken, scabby, and even after a shower, not entirely free of the rotten odor Jane had predicted. When Liz had asked Dr. Facciano how long it would be before her father could drive, the doctor had said 4 to 6 weeks.
"Nor is Nancy Bildyer's house an advertisement for anything," Mr. Bennett said. "If she owns a piece of furniture not covered by dog hair, I've never noticed it."
Liz hadn't expected resistance. Uncertainly, she said, "What if I pay for the first visits?" At present, she had $13,000 in her savings account, an amount that reassured her in comparison to the non-existent nest egg of her sister's, but that also appeared inexplicably low given that her annual income was $105,000, she had no dependents, and apart from living in New York, she wasn't profligate.
"That's not a good use of your money," Mr. Bennett said. "Nor of mine. The answer is no."
"But don't you think the house is kind of a mess? And the yard, too?" Mr. Bennett sounded untroubled as he said,
"Everything tends toward entropy, my dear. It's the second law of thermodynamics."
Chapter 22. To Liz's surprise, both Lydia and Kitty exclaimed with delight on hearing at dinner of Charlotte's charades invitation. "I hope you know I'll kick your asses," Lydia said. And Mary said, "By cheating, you mean?" "What if we're on the same team?" Liz asked. "Is your ass-kicking restricted to your opponents, or is it indiscriminate?" "Do you ever pass up a chance to use a big word?" Lydia replied. "Or do you find that circumlocution always magnifies life's conviviality?" "That wasn't bad," Liz said, "especially for someone who scored as low as you did on the verbal part of the SATs. "Stop quarreling, girls," Mrs. Bennett said. "It's unbecoming."
"They'd never speak to one another otherwise," Mr. Bennett said.
"Chip and I are going out Friday," Jane said. "But if we weren't, I'd love to come."
Charlotte's inviting him, too,
Liz said. And Mrs. Bennet said, I'm sure Chip would rather spend time alone with Jane. A new couple needs space.
Lydia turned to her eldest sister, her voice merry.
Jane, do you think Chip will be the one you lose your virginity to?
Mr. Bennet stood, dropping his napkin on the table.
As interesting as I find this conversation, an urgent matter has come up. I need a hamburger.
Simultaneously, Liz said, Dad, you can't drive. And Jane said, Dad, you can't eat red meat.
Mr. Bennet gestured toward his plate, atop which sat moderate portions of lentil stew prepared by Jane and salad prepared by Liz.
This is unacceptable, he said. I'm not a small woodland creature. Lizzie, we're going to Zips.
Dad, Dr. Morlock is the one who recommended a plant-based diet, Jane said. It wasn't us. The iron in a hamburger will help, Dad, Kitty said. Just don't eat the bun.
That'd be like watching a burlesque show with one's eyes closed, Mr. Bennet said.
Yuck, Mary said.
Mr. Bennet pointed toward the back door.
Hop to, Lizzie.
Liz glanced at Jane, who sighed audibly. This Liz took as tacit permission, and she too stood. The truth, unfortunately, was that the lentils were almost flavorless. Does anyone else want anything? She asked.
Everyone did except for Jane. They requested hamburgers and cheeseburgers and French fries. Though at the last minute, just before Mr. Bennet and Liz walked out the back door, Jane called after them,
Fine, I'll take an order of onion rings.
Chapter 23
Are you still planning to stay in Cincy until September?
Jasper said to Liz over the phone.
Because I don't know if I can wait that long for you to get back.
I was thinking we should meet somewhere for a weekend in August, Liz said. Maybe Cape Cod?
Here's my question, Jasper said. I realize your mom's shindig is the biggest thing ever to happen in her life. But when she claims to be spending her days on nonstop planning, what's she literally doing? Isn't the event at a hotel that's making the food and taking care of the setup?
While Liz had wondered the same thing, she wasn't sure Jasper knew Mrs. Bennet well enough. They'd met only once, years before, to have earned the right to ask. She and the other women are trying to get donations for the silent auction, Liz said. And the proceeds from the auction go to a shelter for homeless teenagers. It's not total society lady fluffiness.
Okay, now you're making me feel like a bad person. But doesn't your mother know I need my nin?
Liz smiled. You know I'm here for my dad, not my mom. Besides, you kept me waiting 14 years. Surely you can wait 2 more months.
What kind of jackass would keep Liz Bennet waiting for 14 years?
Jasper said.
If I ever met that guy, I'd punch his lights out.
Chapter 24
When Caroline Bingley and Fitzwilliam Darcy walked through the door of Charlotte's downtown apartment, the sight of Darcy rattled Liz more than she wished to admit.
Sorry, Jane murmured to Liz.
Chip and Jane had indeed decided to start their evening at Charlotte's, as the newest arrivals headed into the kitchen to obtain drinks.
Are you okay?
Liz squared her shoulders.
Of course.
But Darcy's comment at the Lucas's barbecue about Liz's ostensibly single status?
I suppose it would be unchivalrous to say I'm not surprised.
Had echoed unpleasantly in Liz's head during the last week. Could it have been his spontaneous attempt at wit? Or in their brief encounter, had he taken note of some off-putting feature of her presentation?
disgustingly bad breaths say that no one, even Jane, had ever felt comfortable mentioning? In New York, Liz rarely dwelled on the contours of her romantic life. But in Cincinnati, the irregularity of her arrangement with Jasper had come into sharper focus. Depending on how long Susan's grandmother took to die, it could be several more years before Jasper and Susan officially divorced, and, Liz imagined, she and Jasper moved in together. Eventually, in some low-key ceremony, they would marry. It seemed plausible she'd be the last of her sisters to wed. But Liz didn't share her mother's view of matrimony as a race. After all, she already had a companion to reliably talk things over with, and another body in the bed to reliably curl against. And weren't those marriage's truest prerequisites? And yet, with regard to Jasper, Liz wasn't impervious to self-doubt. At a co-worker's wedding, when filling out a form that required her to declare her marital status or identify an emergency contact, she always wrote Jane's name, or if otherwise confronted with evidence of choices she'd made without necessarily having recognized them as such in the moment, these circumstances all gave her pause. In recent weeks, as she'd repeatedly bumped into former classmates or old family friends, the proof was ample that other people's choices had been different. A few days before, she had met Charlotte for a drink at Don Pablo's, which had once been their favorite restaurant, and as Liz took a sip of her pomegranate margarita, she realized that at the adjacent table, standing up to leave, was their Seven Hills classmate, Vanessa Krager, as well as a bald man who appeared to be Vanessa's husband, and four children between the ages of 5 and 12 who appeared to be their offspring. How was this mathematically possible? And wasn't there, in Vanessa's avid reproduction, something unseemly? Some announcement of narcissism or aggression? It was generally less shocking to Liz that 20 years after high school she was still her essential self. The self she'd grown up as, unencumbered by spouse or child, than that nearly everyone else had changed, moved on, and multiplied. After moderately warm greetings, introductions, and updates, Vanessa was working part-time doing billing for a chiropractor. The family was soon due at the 10-year-old's piano recital. Vanessa said, "Liz, I read your interview with Jillian Northcutt. Do you think Hudson Blaze cheated on her?" 5 years earlier, after the dissolution of one of Hollywood's then most famous marriages, Liz had been the first journalist to interview the actress Jillian Northcutt post-split. That this remained Liz's best-known article was slightly embarrassing. The entirety of the interview, which had happened in a hotel suite, had lasted 18 minutes and occurred in the presence of not only Jillian Northcutt's publicist and personal assistant, but also the publicist's assistant, a silent manicurist and an equally silent pedicurist. While the encounter had paid dividends in subsequent cocktail party conversations, and had even landed Liz on several entertainment talk shows, she actually felt sorry for Jillian Northcutt because of the degree of prurience she inspired. To Vanessa, Liz said, "I think the only people who really know what went wrong are the two of them." Insistently, Vanessa said, "But he and Roxanne DiLorenzo were together like a month later." At this point, Vanessa's husband said, "V, we gotta go." And Charlotte said, "Great to see you, Vanessa." And then the family departed in a commotion that included spilled rice from a polystyrene take-home container, tears, and inter-sibling violence. When they were gone, Charlotte and Liz looked at each other, and at exactly the same time, Liz said, "There but for the grace of God go I," and Charlotte said, "Should I freeze my eggs?" "Jinx?" Liz said. When Charlotte laughed, Liz hadn't been sure she would, Liz was reminded once again of how much she liked her friend. But if Liz's aversion to having children was clear to her,
she was less certain about her romantic status. At times, she wondered why no one besides Jasper had ever truly captured her heart, or perhaps more to the point, why she hadn't captured anyone else's. Because even the half-dozen men she'd dated casually, they had ended things as often as she had, or had seemed less than devastated when she initiated the breakup. These were the unsettling thoughts swirling in Liz's mind as the various guests at Charlotte's apartment procured drinks and greeted one another. In addition to the Bennett sisters and the Bingley contingent, Charlotte had invited a friend of hers from Procter & Gamble whose name was Nathan. He'd brought along his boyfriend, Stephen. Initially, Liz managed to talk exclusively to Nathan and Stephen, whom she hadn't previously met. But after a 20-minute stretch in which she didn't even glance in Darcy's direction, she found herself right beside Caroline Bingley. Caroline was regarding Liz with what the latter woman took to be a rude scrutiny. Given that Caroline was the sister of Jane's new beau, Liz suppressed her own impulse to rudely stare back. Smiling, she said, "Liz Bennett, Jane's sister. We met on the 4th of July." Caroline's pretty features, blue eyes, the lightest smattering of freckles, a delicate and just barely upturned nose, contorted slightly. She said, "Did we?" "Oh, for Christ's sake," Liz thought. "No wonder you and Darcy are friends." "Just briefly," Liz said. "When you told me you were having trouble remembering if you're in Cincinnati, Cleveland, or Columbus." "You're in Cincinnati, by the way." In an unfriendly